Hi, I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite podcast on the Citadel.
Hello, Mixed Nutcases. This is Nuke Chess, and today we've got an episode of Nutty Bites for you about a documentary near and dear to our hearts. It is the Deep Space Nine documentary, What We Left Behind. With me, as usual, I have...
Hi, I'm Tech of the Maquis. Wait, that's not right. Of the Dominion. That's not right. I'm of something. We'll figure it out later.
And I think possibly a first time with us, we have Will.
Hello, I am of the Gamma Quadrant, Alpha Quadrant, sorry.
Whatever quadrant.
Yeah, some quadrant.
And returning guest, Matt.
Hi, it's Matt. I self-identify as El Orion.
Oh, look at you.
Oh, wow.
Well, anyone who's been listening to the podcast knows that I identify as Klingon, and Klingons rock in Deep Space Nine, except for Gowron. Sorry.
No, Gowron starts off amazing, and then they just, they hit him with the writing hammer.
It was horrible. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk a little bit about the documentary. We're going to talk about things that we liked, things that we didn't like. And then we're going to add to it by talking about our experiences with Deep Space Nine, because the documentary did not go well enough into detail, because it's impossible to go well enough into detail. And so we're going to add extra to it. So I think we all saw it the same night, which was Monday night of this week.
Yes, Monday night. It was late Monday night for me because all the early showings had sold out, so I had to go to a 10 o'clock showing, which was tough the next day. But
we only had one showing at 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
So that was our choice. And it was a lot of fun. It was playing 2 days in a row here, and then one matinee in the middle of the week for some reason. And then it's going to go on to DVD, much like our... They Shall Not Grow Old review. This is one of those limited release documentaries.
A lot less crying during this documentary than there was during They Shall Not Grow Old.
Though. Yes, absolutely. A lot less crying. So what was the theater like when you guys went?
When I went, it was late at night. So there were only like a handful, maybe 10 people kind of scattered around the theater. I think if I had gone to the 7 o'clock showing, it would have been packed, because I went to some of the early Fathom events a few years ago when they released like the Next Generation DVDs, and those were all packed.
And when I went, I went into the theater so late because I was waiting for somebody and we had dinner first. And even though we had dinner right across the street, by the time we got there, like when we sat down, the lights went down. So I don't really know. Like, if anyone was, like, dressed in gear or costume, I don't think so. But I'd say there's probably a dozen people there.
We had, what, a third of the theater filled?
No, the theater was about half full. Yeah. We're from a small city, though, only about 100,000 people. So the one showing the first night, there was only one person in gear.
Yeah.
The woman in, I'd say, her 50s, dressed as a Trill.
Yep.
About it. The one point we didn't notice is at the end when they ask all the patrons that supported the movie to stand up and take a round of applause, the two people that were in the audience that took they took photos with their phone of their names in the credits left like 20 seconds before they were told to stand up.
Oh, that's too bad. We had one person stand up.
Oh, that's cool. Nice. Yeah, it was really funny because it's like, all right, and I want the backers to stand up, and I'm like, they left. They were here. Oh, they were sitting right here.
They should have stayed.
Yeah, I will say that the round table at the end was not very illuminating.
It was pretty dull.
It was dull.
And I didn't stick around for the round table.
You didn't miss much.
Okay. You didn't miss much.
I said I could watch it on the DVD.
When we went to the They Shall Not Grow Old, which was the Peter Jackson documentary about World War One, staying for the after... The little talk after was amazing. It was completely worth it. Everything that we learned there was fascinating.
It was basically a 30-minute making of featurette with extra footage of like the in-progress film restoration, showing you how they did it and talked about the footage they didn't use. So it was like it's going to be an added scene on the DVD. So it was well worth watching. I thought we were going to get the same from this roundtable, and we definitely did not. But before we get to railing on the documentary, Let's talk about what it is. So this is Ira, Stephen Bear, and a bunch of other people getting back together 25 years after Babylon 5. After Deep Space Nine has ended, they had 7 seasons on TV. It changed a lot of things about what we know about Star Trek, about what we know about science fiction. But what the documentary exposes is that, you know, there's a lot of personalities involved. There's a lot of yourself that goes into this project. And when everybody from – when all different people throw everything they've got into a project, they can make something special. But it's not without its sacrifices. And, you know, one of the big things about Babylon 5 again. But I got to stop doing that. One thing about Deep Space Nine is that at least in the beginning, it wasn't that popular.
No. And they highlight that.
Absolutely.
They have all the different actors and writers read hate mail. Which,
yeah, very funny.
I loved it. I thought that was fantastic. And we were talking before we started recording that one of them compared it to Babylon 5, saying that it was a cheap ripoff. And the reason why so many people do the Babylon 5 Deep Space Nine thing like Tech was doing is they were on at the same time. And there were a lot of similarities, including actors.
Yeah, a lot of actors crossed over. And even that there's – how much are we spoiling? There's even one part where they kind of do like a hypothetical 8th season. And yes. It reminded me a lot of the Babylon 5 series finale where they're getting back together after – you know, all this time. And
it's not a spoiler to say that one of the main parts of this documentary is that they get all of the main writers together back into a room and they work for a day to basically do a pitch for a mythical season 8 pilot.
And it's good. We won't spoil that part because I think that's the part that you want to watch.
I'd sit down and watch that episode of TV. They say they were a full 26 episode season. I'd watch that season of TV. That'd be great.
I would even say that I liked their treatment so much that if they could pull that off, if they could get everyone to agree to come back, I would forego the Picard series for that.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
That's high praise because I really think that the Picard series, well, I think everybody's kind of anticipating it just because we all love Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, if they can get these, if they can get Ron Moore and Ira Bear working on it, I think that could be really good.
I must say that the fictional 8th season, that whole recurring segment was my least favorite part of the documentary.
Really?
That felt like that could be a bonus feature on the DVD. I would have rather they'd spent 30 minutes more talking about the show we actually had and the more of what the show was.
Especially because there's so much else they missed.
Yeah. There's a lot. There's so much. There's 7 seasons of TV that they can explore. So to spend, I would say it was probably 20 to 30 minutes altogether of that on something that was never going to, like, you're never going to see it. So that felt like a really good bonus feature. I didn't need it in the documentary proper. Is what I want to say.
It was such a tease, though. It made me so mad when I left the theater because they pitched it so well, and it's not being made, and we're never going to see it. And just what have you done to me? Yeah, thanks, guys. Yeah,
more reasons you can get mad at Iris Stephen Bear.
I didn't miss. Yeah, as if those dorky glasses and that blue beard wasn't enough. Now I have more reasons to hate him, and just. All the problems I have with modern sci-fi, if they did bring a season 8 of DS9 back to TV, DS9 was the dark Star Trek, where they took all the lights from TNG and they went, and they turned everything down. But, you know, I'm going through right now for the first time watching Discovery, where they basically took the last Star Trek and... turned all the lights down again. If everything must be darker and gritty and more real, by the time we get to a season 8 of DS9, it's just going to be a black screen with text.
And everybody's going to talk like Sam and Dean.
Right, yeah. Everybody in pro wrestler voices with a blacked out screen and subtitles. The occasional flash and a transporter effect, and you're not going to see anything.
Can we address the blue furry carpet in the room?
Oh, Ira, what are you doing, buddy?
it was distracting. I am all for people taking claim and ownership over their own image and how they want to dress and everything. I will say the blue goatee was very distracting because it didn't even look real, although it just made
me wonder how far down the blue went, though.
Oh, boy. Thankfully, I didn't think that. But when you looked at pictures of him when he was younger, he's always been hiding his face with hair and glasses and hats. And I just kind of want to say, Ira, it's okay. You can show people your face. Mm. But yeah, that I found distracting. I wish that they spent a little bit more time maybe at conventions and they added more fan component. It seemed to me that the fans that they did interview were all backers.
Yeah, I think that was the point.
Yeah,
that's fair.
It's fair, but I think, again, if we were going to add more to this, that's what I would like to see. One thing that I loved about Trekkies was how much that they went and they talked to fans and they talked about how.
Yeah, but then one of them went and wrote Nemesis. So
yes, and it was better than what we actually got because then they screwed Nemesis up from the original plot. Yes, watch Trekkies, the original version of Nemesis. Is in Trekkies.
Oh. Okay. I haven't seen that, so I will have to watch that. And I also want to watch that Elle Fanning movie, too.
Elle Fanning movie. Which is that?
The one, what was it called? Something. It's about a girl who writes a Star Trek script and tries to. I don't know.
I don't know this. I have to look this up. Okay.
Yeah, there's a scene at the end of Trekkies where they're meeting with this teenager and he's in his bedroom. It's like, oh, I wrote a speculative script and I'm trying to sell it. And it all has to do with this ship called the Scimitar and about Romulus and Remus. And
he's actually filming it. And it's like Nemesis is the name of the space station, the Romulan space station. And
next thing you know, Nemesis fail. Anyway,
I
want to say about Ira Stephen Bear that he is, despite the goatee and the glasses, such a great ambassador for Deep Space Nine. So enthusiastic, so kind, so like I really enjoyed being in his company. Mm-hmm. I thought he was great. I really liked him.
It goes back to a quote that I keep ripping off and I keep saying, and I will keep saying it, is the greatest thing about Star Trek is that growing up watching these shows when I didn't have any friends for 1 hour a week, it felt like I did. And it goes to show that it's not just the characters, but it's the people making it. They put their heart into this, you know, for 7 seasons, and that heart really shines through. You know, you genuinely feel like real emotions, not only for the characters, but for the people.
One of the things that I absolutely love is that you can tell that Iris still loves Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. He loves what they did. He loves the universe and he's still living there. And that to me is really good, especially when you hear, I think the quote is from Rick Berman, who said, "There are no more stories to tell in Star Trek." Shut up, Rick. Yeah. There are tons of stories we can tell.
Yeah, even in the documentary, he was kind of like, yeah, you kind of conned me into, you know, doing this show or something like that.
Yeah. I will say that all of the actors, from what we saw of them, they all looked amazing.
Except Nog.
Nog looked all right. I mean, how old is he? He's like, you know, how old is he?
Older than us.
Yeah, so he looked fine. He looked fine.
Terry Farrell looks really. I think I had kind of a crush on her when I was watching Deep Space Nine.
It's Jadzia.
There's no kinda. I have a crush on Terry Farrell. She looked amazing.
I didn't realize she was that young when she started, and that green.
And I think they talk about how people grow as actors. Shane says in the chat that Nana Visitor looks great for someone in her 60s. She does. And that's not like Hollywood makeup making her look that good. A friend of mine just recently came back from a convention and he's got pictures with her and some video.
I think she looks better now.
Yeah, I think she looks better now than she did then because she's just kind of so comfortable in her skin.
The white hair is a great look.
Oh, it's such a good look. But everything I've ever heard about Nana is that she is one of the best people. And you can see that come through in the documentary, because she's in every step of it all the way through the credits. And she's able to rip on people without anyone taking offense, because they all know that she's coming from a good place. One of the things I absolutely adored about this documentary was someone would tell a story and then two other people would go, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
That's not how I remember it, which to me is like, yeah, these are old people telling old stories and everyone's memory is going to be different. That's exactly what happened.
Those arguments were great.
Oh, they were fantastic.
When you were talking about this being the dark Star Trek, so this show actually premiered on my birthday back in 1993. I was 12 years old and I was a TNG fan.
Gulp.
And of course I was very excited for another Star Trek show, apprehensive that it was on a space station, that it wasn't on a ship. But I remember very distinctly not liking Deep Space Nine for quite a long time. I remember not liking Kira because she was anti-Federation, and I'm a pro-Federation person because that's how I was sculpted to to be, you know, to be on Sisko's side. So this, I didn't like Kira. I didn't like how angry she was. I didn't get it. I didn't get all the politics. I didn't get that the Cardassian occupation was supposed to be, you know, an allegory for apartheid or whatever. I was 12 years old. So it wasn't until the Dominion War kicked off, and I think it was the episode where Odo goes to his planet finally and finds that his people are the founders, where I was like, oh, wow, this is really good. And then after that, I was hooked. And of course, now I love it from start to finish. But it definitely was a show that, for my age at the time, didn't resonate with me at first. I wasn't mature enough to handle it.
Mm. Will, what was your first experience with Deep Space Nine?
Oh, well, of course, I was a fan of The Next Generation and just wanted to watch it because I love Star Trek. And I don't know why I was at my grandmother's place, but I do remember watching the pilot on a Saturday afternoon at my grandmother's house. And I remember liking the show from the beginning. I'm not sure if I liked Kira or not, but I liked Odo, the Doctor, Quark, and it was on syndication back then, so I think part of the trouble was like knowing when it was on, because I went to college during its run and had to figure out when it was going to be on. And then I know at one point it was coming on Friday late at night, like 11 or something, and that was when I was either going to movies with friends or playing online games with friends. So I missed, I think, most of season 5 and 6. So I still have to go back and watch those. I've been saying that for 20 years now.
Oh, you should do a podcast.
I think I finally just admitted to myself that DS9 is the best Star Trek show. I always want to say The Next Generation, but The Next Generation is probably my favorite still, but I would say DS9 is the best. And watching the documentary just made me want to go back and start watching it over again from the beginning.
Absolutely. I think Deep Space Nine is the best just because it's so character driven.
Absolutely.
We recently did a rewatch and I've decided definitively, I used to go back and forth. Deep Space Nine is the best to me because all of the characters are rounded and figured out from the get-go. They have places to go, but it's nobody's trying to figure out who their characters are at the beginning. It is very clear who everyone is. Tech, what was your first experience with Deep Space Nine?
I don't know. Growing up as a young teenager, I remember watching the pilot. I remember liking it. I remember it being, okay, it's Star Trek with more guns. I'm okay with this. I can watch a Star Trek where they fight every episode. I'm all cool with that. Less politics, more fighting. But it was on Saturdays at the same time as Babylon 5. So it was always a choice of which one do you want to watch. So I remember the first couple of seasons of flicking back and forth using the previous button on the remote of, okay, is it going to be it's a Kira-heavy episode. All right, yeah, but we got the Shadow War on B5. I'm going to go watch the Shadow War, you know, and flipping back and forth trying to figure out which episode I wanted to watch until my late teen years. You know, I joined the army and life got in the way, and I didn't watch the Dominion War until a couple years ago. I didn't watch season 5. I don't think I still haven't seen season 5 of Babylon 5 because, well, it's awful.
You've seen parts of it.
By the first couple episodes and just can't force myself to watch the rest of it. I never...
But they want 6 credits for Spoo, if you can believe that.
I don't even know what that means. I never, ever saw... I think I may have seen a handful of episodes of Enterprise. It was on the same time as The Simpsons. I'm not missing The Simpsons for Scott Bakula. Sorry.
So I was about 16 years old, when 15, 16 when it started, and I, like Tech, had the choice. On Channel 11, there was Deep Space Nine, and on Channel 9, there was Babylon 5, and I had to choose, and I said... I already know I love Star Trek.
What a Sophie's choice.
Yeah, you know, so this, by the way, kids who are listening who are younger, this is back in the days where there were channels that weren't network channels, and so things weren't on at the same time for everybody. So if you lived 3 states over, it might be on at a different time.
Let me say something spooky without an explicit filter for all of the kids that are listening. And you couldn't fast forward through the commercials.
No. There were no DVRs. You could tape them on VHS, but not all VHSs could tape and watch another channel.
I believe I probably made my parents. If I don't have this scenario we were talking about, yes, where 2 of my favorite shows are on the same time, but I know what I would have done as a kid. I'm watching it in one room, and I'm taping it the other show in the other room.
Right.
Wait, you had 2 TVs in your house?
I would have had 2 TVs, and I would have had a TV guide so that I could know when everything was on.
Yeah, we didn't have 2 TVs.
I didn't mess around, okay?
Actually, technically, we did. I had a little 13-inch black and white in my room, but it didn't have a VHS on it.
The black and white TV in the basement had 13 channels.
Yeah, that was the main TV in the living room, which was also a piece of furniture.
I still have a lot of those old TV guides. I always kept the Star Trek covers.
He collects TV guides?
Back then I did. I don't anymore.
That's the kind of nerd Will is. I love it. But yeah, so I remember watching it and choosing Star Trek. And I remember my dad liked Star Trek. He's the one that first got me into it, kind of. I really accidentally found it on my own and then found out he liked it. So I was really excited. Yes.
No, I have a question for everyone. I was going to let you finish your point.
Okay. So I remember my dad was away on ship, and he comes home, and I remember trying to tell him about Deep Space Nine and how excited I was for it, because I was thrilled. I was really excited about Deep Space Nine, and he basically tore everything I said about it down, saying how that's not Star Trek. That's not Star Trek. And I remember it hurting me so much. I'm like, no, you don't understand. This is amazing. They've got real aliens and politics and this. And he's like, that's not Star Trek. Growing up, becoming a full-blood Trekkie, I can tell him, no, Star Trek has always been about politics. It has always been about diversity. It has always been about these things. Shut up. You're not a real Trekkie. I, like Will, also lost some of the seasons due to going to university. And then did come back for the Dominion War. And then I've recently gone through a full rewatch, and they stand up. They stand up today. And what's going on in the world today? We really need to watch Deep Space Nine again. Tech, what's your question?
My question is for everyone. Everyone seems to have, or at least a few of us, found the... As good as it was, the pilot in the first season, like with a lot of Trek, is problematic. So does anyone remember an episode, or was there a point when you go, well, hey, wait a minute, this is actually a lot better than I thought at first. This is actually really, really good. Because as much as it was Star Trek guns, it was still dark and it was still kind of...
When did you decide...
Yeah.
That this was your show?
For me, it was the episode where Odo and Lwaxana Troi are locked in a turbo lift.
That's a great episode.
And it's just such wonderful acting between the two of them. I really enjoyed that episode, and it just sort of made me think that this is something different. Okay, they're on a space station. Okay, there's lots of shooting, and, you know, there's lots of you know, war stuff going on, but at the heart of it is a, you know, a workplace drama of all these people that don't like each other that all have to live together, and it's really, really, really good. And that episode, to me, was the corner I turned.
Mm.
I'm assuming that Matt didn't like that episode.
I don't remember having a problem with it, but it's been so long since I've seen the first season. One episode that stands out, I think, was when what's her name? Vedic Wynn, Kai mm-hmm. Wynn, the one where she died. Spoiler alert: the one where she dies. That one like really affected me. I was really yeah. sad that that happened.
Yeah, that was a really.
Wait,
not
when
you're thinking of the original.
You're thinking of Kaiopaka.
Yeah, Kaiopaka. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so
not when everybody hated
it. I was thinking Kai Wynn. She died in the war at the end. I mean, well, you waited a while to turn around.
Yeah,
but no, I agree.
Up.
That one really kind of makes you vested in the whole overarching plot, the emissary, and everything else.
Okay, cool. So this is the episode, it's called Battle Lines in season one. This is the episode where I kind of tuned out because I hated this episode. And I still kind of hate this episode because I don't find that Kaiopaka has much appeal to me. She's so kind of one note, so matronly, so kind of dull. And I don't really like all the spirituality stuff. And this to me was a very dark episode, a very gritty, but not necessarily in a great way kind of episode. I didn't like the aliens. I don't know. It was just, it seems kind of stupid. I really, at the time, hated this episode, and I don't think I like it very much more now.
All right.
So that's what I love.
Wait. This is what I love about Deep Space Nine is that there's something for everyone.
So what brought you back?
It was probably that season two finale episode where they introduced the Dominion and the Jem'Hadar. It's actually called the Jem'Hadar. And I believe Odo goes to the planet and finds his people and realizes that this threat that's been out there, that he is of them. And I thought, oh, my God, that's so heavy. And I remember going, oh, wow, that's such a shock. And, like, I had to watch it from there on.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm not sure what like really made me completely sold and bought in. I remember being really excited about it at the beginning. There are a couple early episodes that jump out at me. One of them being when the female Ferengi comes and she's pretending to be a man and she's doing that whole deal with Quark. I love that episode. There's also the episode where a Trill basically forces Jadzia to give up Dax, and it leaves Jadzia for like a couple hours before they can get it back into her.
That was an awesome episode.
Those episodes to me were just, they really,
that was so good.
I loved whenever they took anything where it was, this is the established idea. Okay, now we're going to show you another side of it. Because in that Trill episode, it was the established idea is this is how the symbiotes are given and how they pass from life to life. And then this is somebody saying, no, you misjudged. That's unfair. I deserve a chance. And there's also episodes where like Kira comes into question. It's like, okay, so Kira's our first officer. She was a freedom fighter. No, Kira's a terrorist. Kira did horrible things, and she'll just sit there and say, yes, I did, but it was war, and I'm not going to apologize.
Well, there's that episode they talked about in the documentary about where, you know, the one where Kira has to come face with what she's done when she meets that Cardassian, and they realize that, you know, they're pretty much the same person,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, they've both killed a lot of people, and that there is no good side to a war. You can stand on whatever high ground you want, but at the end of the day,
if you killed civilians, you killed civilians. Yeah. You know, as she said, did I want to, did I want to murder civilians? Did I want to attack buildings that had civilians? Well, they were with the Cardassians, so they were collaborators. You know, and that's how she justified it. They're still civilians. Mm. And you don't know their reasons. And when we go through Deep Space Nine, one of the things that I love is that we see that everybody had a reason for doing something. Odo was a collaborator, you know, her mother was a collaborator. There's so many other people that she would have killed that became very important to her. And Yeah. So Shane says in the chat that his first Deep Space Nine episode was Crossover. So that's the one when they go to the Mirror Universe.
Yes.
And we get the Intendant, which is... I will say...
Formative to my youth, I think, is a good way to explain that episode.
Yeah. I will say that Deep Space Nine, of all the Star Trek series so far... And I'm only finished season one of Discovery, so I don't know all of season two. Deep Space Nine did the Mirror Universe the best because there was a full continuity. Well, they had multiple Mirror Universe episodes. And
that being said,
back.
We just watched the first Mirror Universe episode of Discovery, and they brought back the goatee.
Yes, they did.
On Sarek. So that happy. Made me very happy that the goatee is back.
I do like Mirror Universe and Discovery.
It's a lot of fun.
I have seen some criticism of the intendant. People in the queer community don't like that the show's kind of first bisexual character is so... overly sexualized.
Okay. I can see that complaint. I can definitely see that complaint.
Yeah, but she's having fun. You can see it.
She's having fun. I'm just saying
I don't agree
with that necessarily, but people do wish that, oh, she's evil and sexy, therefore she's bisexual.
Yeah.
Like all right.
I can see that complaint because that is a trope and a go-to.
Yeah.
You know,
if you're evil and sexy, you're over sexual, and then it's just everything is sexy. Yeah. And I get that. I don't think that they're, in writing that character, I don't think that's I don't want to say fair, but I don't think that's a just criticism because it's not like they went out and said, you know what? All right, see, what we're going to do is we're going to write a first bisexual character, yeah? And we're going to make her suck, you know? It's going to be awful. She's going to be horrible. She's going to be over-sexualized, and the bis are going to hate us forever. Yeah, all right, write it down, boys. Yeah.
I think it was more along the lines of it was in a time that to them
in
they
a
didn't...
time.
In a time.
In a fabled time of yore called the 90s.
Yes, that they didn't even think that they were writing a bisexual character. They thought, we're just going to write everything that's opposite of Kira... And we're going to make this person use sex against everyone because it's the one thing Kira doesn't do. But that said, it is a trope. I mean, even before Joss decided that Willow was going to be gay, spoiler alert for Buffy, Vamp Willow in their Mirror Universe is also very bisexual. So, you know, it is a trope that people fall into and, you know, it's fair. It's fair.
So people who have a healthy sexual appetite are evil is kind of
pretty much.
Wait, I'm not
women,
buying.
Women who have a healthy sexual appetite are evil. Let's not forget that. Kirk was never deemed as evil.
Let's talk about a character who is quote unquote evil, who has no sexual appetite, and that's Kai Winn. And why was she absent from this documentary? And I don't just mean Louise Fletcher, who is still alive, and I would have loved to have had some insight from her, but her character isn't really talked about, and she is such an antagonist.
Yeah.
She makes you hate her so well.
Child.
But it's so good, and when you watch it with today's eyes, and you realize that she's the evangelical Bajoran.
It was a point that I was going to bring up a little later, but you know, they say that a villain is the hero of his own story, and that I have never seen it on Trek or on TV better than in DS9. The villains they have are so fully fleshed out, and you know, Kai Winn is the perfect example that she thinks that throughout the entire arc from the beginning of her story all the way through the Dominion War, she's doing the best for her. She's doing what she thinks is right.
Yeah.
And it's written beautifully.
Yeah, Dukat is another one. He was always my favorite villain on the show. And the documentary, he's hilarious.
Oh, he cracked me up in the documentary.
I love him. Yeah. He's crazy.
I did like how they said that thanks to the makeup, he got to be a leading man.
Oh.
But
The one thing I will say that I'm glad they got rid of, because it was in TNG, but I'm glad they got rid of it in DS9. Does anybody else remember the Cardassian helmets?
Oh,
No.
Oh, they're awful. It's this weird sort of like a brown leather, like a nose strap sort of a thing. It's not even a full helmet. It's just like a – I don't even know how to describe it. It's awful. There you go.
Yes. It basically looks like Cardassian bondage. I'm going to send you a picture.
Okay.
I can't believe someone in the prop department thought this was a good idea.
You know, they can't all be winners, right? they really can't. No, I did want to say that for the Ferengi, it's surprising how little makeup was used for many of them.
Oh, my God. That headgear is insane.
The headgear is insane, but like if you notice, like for the guy that plays Rom, he has very pronounced lower teeth. So his character had very pronounced lower teeth, you know, and the big joke is Armin Shimerman has big ears, so they didn't have to do much there. But it cracks me up, like, and well, they not add- cracks me up. It shows me the artistic sense that the makeup artists and the prosthetics are actually done to match the actor.
Yeah, they added a lot less than we'd believe. It's like, wow, they gave Rom such a huge nose. Well, they kind of added some bumps to it, and that was kind of, they kind of called it a day.
Well, it's like when you see Ron Perlman as Hellboy, you know? I mean, there's really
wow,
not
look at
that
the
much.
Chin on that guy. Yeah. Well, that's like the one part of his head that doesn't have makeup.
I feel getting back to their villains, in addition to we've got Gul Dukat, who definitely sees himself as the hero of his story. You've got Damar, who does this full redemption arc.
Okay, can we talk about Damar for just a sec?
Go right
I had
ahead.
Completely forgotten that he existed until
the documentary.
Yeah.
Okay, so Damar is played by an actor named Casey Biggs, and he's from my hometown of Toledo, Ohio.
Really?
You may know his former wife. They're divorced now. Roxanne Dawson Biggs. She played B'Elanna Torres.
Yes,
on
I didn't
Star
know
Trek
they
Voyager.
Were married.
Wow.
Yeah, they were married for a time. So
wait, Damar was married to a member of the Maquis?
That's awesome.
Maquis? Yes.
Maquis?
So yeah. Anyway, Casey Biggs is
he's
got a lot to do in this documentary, actually, because you know they had him singing at the end, but
yeah,
and he can sing.
Yeah. So anyway, hometown hero for me.
He's done other things, though, hasn't he?
I'm sure he's done a lot of things. But
speaking of that song, does anybody else remember a time that Damar and Wei Yun sang a four-point harmony with two Ferengi?
I speaking of you know, recurring guest actors, I'm so glad that Jeffrey Toombs was
Coombs.
Hmm?
Coombs.
Sorry, whatever. Anyway. What did I say? Toombs? No, Coombs. Yeah. it was such a big part of this documentary because, I mean, like, he's such a big part of Star Trek now.
Yeah.
And if you think, like, a big part is Deep Space Nine. I mean, he played three different aliens in Deep Space Nine, recurring. And then he was in Voyager. He was in TNG. And then he had a main recurring role in Enterprise. Yeah. I'm just waiting for him to show up in Discovery. I mean,
there's still time.
It's got to happen, right?
Even as a bit part in one episode, a throwaway, you know, Ensign number 3 in the background who gets sucked out the airlock.
Saru meets his Kelpian brother, and it turns out it's Jerry Coates.
Who's short and really angry for some reason.
Yes.
So I have another question. So we talked about formative episodes that turned us around the corner. What's that one that sticks in your head as one that you just don't like?
It was mentioned in the documentary.
Alamarain!
The stupid game.
I'm a friend of DeSoto, which means I listen to the podcast The Greatest Generation, and they're covering Deep Space Nine right now, and they play a game at the end of every podcast called... it's called, well, I don't remember actually what the name of the game is. Something like Game of Buttholes, Will of the Prophets. Anyway, it's like a Chutes and Ladders thing where they roll dice to find out. They move along a board.
Do they have to sing that?
How they're going to record the next episode, like if they're going to be drunk or not. Well, they record it. Anyway, they always play sound clips from Move Along Home. So you hear this this guy rolling dice. You're required to learn as you play. Roll. Chula! Did I win? Hardly. Anyway, So when they started playing that, because I went with a guy who also listens to that podcast, it's just when they were doing that, he goes, "Did I win?" And I go, "Hardly." That was a clip for us and no one else. So I like that episode only because of that.
But I think they were, you know, they kind of were right on the nose there that everybody can go, yeah, that was not a great episode.
It wasn't a great episode, but again, I was like 12 years old at the time, and I remember wanting those kinds of episodes that you would get on TNG, like mm-hmm. Clues or Masks or Frame of Mind or The yeah. Game. You know, weird, trippy, puzzle, mystery kind of episodes. And so, and I was also into games and board games and video games. So, hey, our characters are inside of a game. To me, it was fun. It was cool. I really liked it as a kid. Now I can see it's pretty bad.
I think that makes a big difference is how old are you when you're watching this? I think, you know, me, I was like 16 years old, so I was a little bit older when I started watching this. It's not that we're that, we have a huge difference in age, but the younger you are, the bigger the difference is.
So what's the one crappy episode?
Oh, I think I said it. It was the Skimmerimmin Kadinka Dink. Oh, you mean from Matt. Yeah, Matt, what's your crappy episode?
He just said it. You meant
oh, I think I said Battle Lines was probably the one. But I mean, going back and looking at season one, If Wishes Were Horses is pretty terrible.
Which is that one?
That's the one where their fantasies come true.
I don't even remember that one.
Well, there you go.
There's an awful one from season, I think it's season one, where there's a this alien comes through the wormhole. And he has like a personal cloak and all of these other things. And they find out that he's like the genetically engineered to be the perfect prey as he's hunted by these other things from the Gamma Quadrant. And it was just, it really felt like one of those TNG season two disused scripts.
Yeah, pretty generic. That one's called Captive Pursuit.
Yeah.
What I remember about that one, what always sticks in my mind, is how he made fun of Chief O'Brien and humans for having to sleep so much. Like, you got to sleep for 8 hours a day. Like a fourth of your day, you have to be asleep. Like I sleep for like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, that's pretty cool. I want that ability.
I know, right? I always joke like I want to get my sleep removed, but we all know what happened to Lauren. I do think it's interesting to note that DS9 is the Star Trek that Q did not work well on.
I was just about to say that was going to be my episode. But it does have one of my a great moment where Sisko actually punches Q. It just tells you just the kind of man Sisko is.
I mean, that's when the hawk comes out, right?
Yeah. That episode and that punching to me is when we get very definitively, there are a couple of times when we get a Sisko is not Picard.
Yeah.
And that is it. And I love it.
We were talking about... Mm. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, just look how much better that Sisko is with his son compared to how much Picard tries to estrange from his son.
Yes, which is Wesley. Yeah.
Shut up, Wesley.
The boy.
The boy.
The boy.
And I don't think I really like Sisko at the beginning either. And I wonder if it's because maybe it's my age and the fact that so much of his character is about being a father. Or maybe it's that Avery Brooks needed to grow into the role. Or maybe it's that they were trying to make him a different kind of person than when he shaved his head and he got the goatee. And I feel like he was like almost being handicapped by the producers at the time.
Mm. I agree. There is definitely that expression when it comes to Trek where you have to grow into the beard. And Deep Space Nine, even though it started out really good, they grew into the beard, and that's when Sisko grew his beard.
I mean, even we talk about TNG, like it's the great holy grail of science fiction, but
we all saw season two.
We all saw season two. Hey, let's end it with a clip show.
Oh,
Dr. Pulaski.
Don't walk on the grass.
Oh, yeah, death penalty for walking past that white fence that's 6 inches high. Oh, my gosh. Oh,
yeah, early
two.
TNG was pretty bad, too.
You
have possibly a higher standard for Deep Space Nine because you hope that they've learned the lessons
right.
Yeah.
From TNG. And when you find they make an episode like If Wishes Were Horses or Move Along Home or whatever. You're like, I guess you didn't learn the lesson.
Yeah, okay, so I don't care how many more DC Fontana scripts you found hidden in a trunk in the backyard. Okay, you're okay. Not bringing them back.
To be fair, the bad ones were not DC Fontana's.
It was just the only yes. script writer from that Toss that I could of. Remember. So
yes, well, let's not besmirch Dorothy's name. Thank no. you very much. What was I going to say? I completely forgot. I'm sorry.
Well, in defense of Disco, oh. I mean, this isn't a Discovery yeah. podcast, but I do feel like those characters are fully baked from moment one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that show really hits the ground running and doesn't let up. And I feel like that's actually its problem, is that it does not let up.
I find myself wishing for – okay, so I'm getting 12 episodes in season one. We're at what? Episode 10, I think, now. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to double that and give me Monster of the Week episodes interspersed with my episodic story and they just sort of took their time – because there are characters on that bridge that I don't even know if they've said their name yet.
Yeah, I remember after season one, I was thinking, I still don't know the names of half the people on the bridge. Like, who are these people?
Yeah.
Like the black helm officer with the mohawk yeah. and the shaved sides. They've said her name a couple of times. She's had like three lines. And that black and white android at the back...
who's actually a cyborg, but I only know that from a fan who tells me about season
right,
two.
But I know yeah. nothing yeah. of that character other than like the really cool makeup. So why are they investing the 6 hours in the makeup chair that they have to put in for that poor girl in the costume to not use it?
Yeah. One of the things that I did want to say is, you know, when we talk about Bad Trek, I was hooked from the first episode I watched, which... at the time was the worst episode. It was TNG Hotel Royale.
I like that episode.
I love that episode, but I know it's bad.
Again, so bad.
I was a kid and I thought it was really a cool premise of people trapped in a place.
Yeah,
like, that's,
me too.
That's about as far, that's as deep as I went.
And that's as deep as you wanted it.
The one I really yeah. hated was the one where the first TNG episode where you meet the Ferengi. And Riker is stuck on this planet. They've got those dorky laser whips. And at one point, he gets up onto this cliff, and he's looking around. Picard? Worf? Anybody? I hate that so much.
Does he have a beard yet?
No.
That's why.
I know.
It's one episode where they're on a train or something going to Vertiform City. I still talk about Vertiform City sometimes.
Oh, wasn't that the Data Dream episode? He's got the phone in his chest. Yes. He's eating the Deanna Troi.
I think that's a different one. Okay.
You're mixing two of them, but yeah, I think it is a Data thing.
Nuclear peptide cake
with mint frosting.
Yeah. Were the kind of episodes I wanted from Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. But you know, I realize now as a fully grown human or human, if I was Frankie,
what
Deep Space Nine was.
One thing the documentary never mentioned that they should have at least thrown a hat on is what did they do in the what it felt like in DS9 is when they're in the writer's room and they didn't know what to do. What do you want to do in this episode? I don't know. Do you want to torture Miles O'Brien? All right, let's do that.
That's the thing that drives me nuts is they talked about PTSD and they never mentioned Miles.
They the poster boy for PTSD. That boy,
yeah. Well, he came to Deep Space Nine with PTSD. He was in the Cardassian War. He has history.
He was he did all the big Borg battles.
Yeah.
He saw the aftermath of Wolf 359 like everybody else. I mean, he is a battle-scarred chief petty officer with a full career of horrific things, and then we get seven seasons of...
having him live a life sentence in a prison, yeah. having him go and go undercover, get a whole family, and then lose them all. I mean, they did everything possible. Oh, having his daughter all grown up and then having to kill her. I mean, like, there's so many things that he had to go through. I just, ugh. And they didn't even talk about the relationship between Miles and Bashir and how, like, I think if he didn't
the
have
relationship.
That. Yes, the relationship. If he didn't have that, he would be dead. There's no way he would still be a functioning human being.
It's one of Star Trek's best friendships.
It really is. I mean, like,
I did
Kirk,
like
Spock, get out of here. No, it's Bashir and O'Brien.
I do like the actor that played Garak when he acknowledged that he played his character as gay and was trying to get in Dr. Bashir's pants.
Yeah, it's like, well, what did you think that your character's motivations when he first met Bashir was? He just wanted to sleep with him. And it's like, yeah. So I love that they acknowledged that. I don't love that they didn't go far enough. And that they said, oh, maybe we should have pushed the envelope. No, because they're actually denying history there, because they wrote in CL when they realized that fans thought Garak was gay. That was reactionary. It wasn't a, oh, maybe there's subtext thing.
The character CL, you mean?
Yeah.
As a love interest for Garak.
For Garak. Because Andrew Robinson will always tell people, yeah, I played it as gay. And it, when they,
I'll be right back.
You know, when they wrote something in and they are adding this character of CL, and I'm like, wait, isn't he gay? That he really was playing it. Now, when I was 16 years old, I didn't pick up on it.
I didn't either. Just like on Babylon 5, I didn't pick up on that until, you know, I'm forgetting names now. Talia and
Ivanova.
Ivanova, yeah.
How could you forget Ivanova's name? Remember, Ivanova is always right.
She's always right. Speaking of Babylon 5, there is a little bit of talk about Babylon 5, but I think I was actually watching, I didn't start watching Babylon 5 until like into season 3, so this would have been, DS9 would have been the first show I saw with like a long ongoing story once they started the Dominion War.
So you can see why some people think like that they ripped each other off.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, based on the way that the viewing schedules were. I just want to say, like, the whole Garak Bashir thing, yeah, I didn't get it. I definitely didn't see Talia and Ivanova. But then as an adult, I'm like, how did I miss this? How did I not see this? This is obvious. So, yeah. You know.
Another
'90s.
Yeah. Another missed thing from the documentary was, you know, when they talk about, you know, Bill Mumy being on the show. And it's like, hey, you know, we finally killed Will Robinson, you know? Well, you're right. He was Will Robinson, but you're not even going to mention the fact that he's Lanier from Babylon 5.
Yeah, also killed Lanier.
Very odd. That was very odd that they didn't mention that he was a Babylon 5 actor.
Yeah.
That was so random. Like, there are certain things where it's like, okay, you're going out of your way to leave this out. And I think that was one of them, one of those cases. I think that, so like I said, I think that there are certain things that they acknowledge, but they kind of make it a little prettier than maybe it actually was. I like
you're talking
that
about Terry Farrell.
I was actually talking about the whole Garak being gay thing, but yeah, that was leading me into, you know, I like that Terry Farrell got to air her grievances and she's like, yeah, this is how I was treated. And then when you get to the executive producer and he's like, oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure she's heard the same thing from many producers before she even talked to me. No, it doesn't matter. You're the boss. You know what was going on. And that's your diplomatic way of dealing with this.
So it sounds like it was about money and contract negotiations. But I'd always heard a rumor that it was about Rick Berman being sexually aggressive toward her or making her over-sexualizing the character somehow, making her uncomfortable in that way.
I had not heard that one, but I'm not like, I never wanted to know more simply because I knew that I wasn't going to be happy, if that makes sense. I'm like, I knew it was wrong and I didn't want to really find out more. But if that's the case, that...
I never knew why. I would just figure she was ready to move on. I guess in the year since then, I never thought to go and try to find out why. So it was nice to see it brought up in the documentary.
It's also the same thing that happened in Babylon 5.
Yeah.
I also liked that, you know, so many years later when she filmed that clip that she's still very emotional about it because
it was such an important decision made for very important reasons. You know, this wasn't a whim. This wasn't just an actor having a tantrum. This was somebody that had poured their heart and soul into their job and had to make a heartbreaking choice and, yeah. you know, made the right choice for, yeah. for the reasons that she had and is still completely emotionally invested in them. And, Terry, if you're listening, and I know you're listening, I was always on your side. There have been many debates on this podcast in the past over who was the better Dax host. And I stand alone on Team Jedzia, while the rest of the traitors seem to like that little Ezri snot for some reason.
So, I like Ezri. Shut up.
Well, no, I'm not, because I'm talking to Terry right now, so we can all shush.
Team Jedzia, sorry.
Atta boy. So you know what, Terry? You can always come and have a glass with me, and we can talk about old times, old man.
And my answer to this was always, why not both?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I like them both.
I when I was younger, I think I was more in the Ezri camp. I was like, yeah, this is really great. I love this fish out of water. I love the fact that she didn't want the symbiote, that yes. she like refused to even test for it. Watching it as a 40 something, I'm like, oh my God, she's so young. Mm-hmm. Like, so young. And it changes my perspective. I will give credit to the writers and to the actors that they made the best of a bad situation. But I think the documentary points it out, like, you know, you screwed up when you lose a main character in your last season. Like, you should have been able to hold on to her.
I really like that they didn't try to shoehorn in a relationship with Worf, and that they wrote that in, that they were, you know, different ways, that they just didn't, that it wasn't just a full on replacement. Like, yeah. yeah. You know what we did? Yeah, we replaced it with someone hotter and younger. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I don't know about hotter.
Yeah,
but
I was just going to say, are you saying that Nicole DeBoer is hotter than
I'm saying to the cigar smoking mustache twirling fantasy Hollywood exec that I've invented in my mind.
Your Snidely Whiplash.
My Snidely Whiplash
might be named Rick Berman.
As a film exec, it's Bermanstein. That he would think so, that, you know, they're both really attractive in different ways.
What I liked about Ezri is that she goes to this place that where everybody thinks that they know her, and she has to constantly assert, you don't know me. Like, you reference things I don't have context for. You treat me like I'm this other person. I'm not that person. Like, she's losing her individuality, and it's kind of tragic in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we had had more time with her. I think that's unfortunate. I kind of wish that Jedzia had exited a little earlier so we had more Ezri. I like them both.
If that's the way things were going to go, yeah. But I agree. I think that I think the whole that's not me. I have that memory, but that I didn't experience it. You know, it's Jedzia felt the memories of her previous hosts a lot more than Ezri did. And maybe that has something to do with the fact that she was prepared better, yada, yada. Originally, they thought only some Trill could actually, you know, be a host. And then they found out, no, that's a lie.
Spoilers. Hello.
We're doing a review on a documentary of Deep Space Nine. There's going to be spoilers. We already said who died.
Our friends Matt and Mel went to this documentary having not seen the last, let's see, seasons 4, 5, 6, 7. So I think they're somewhere mid-season 3. So I was trying to think, like, what did this documentary spoil? I guess it spoils that Sisko goes to live with the wormhole aliens.
Yep. And it spoils that Jedzia dies.
Jedzia dies, but it doesn't really talk about how the Dominion War ends.
No.
So that was kind of left unresolved in the documentary. So.
And getting back to where we said, like, the villains were really well thought out, the founders, when you saw things from their perspective, you understood why they did the things that they did. And that all it took to convince them was for them to join with Odo.
Mm. I want to go swim in the Founder Lake.
I bet it's super slippery.
you could probably simulate that if you really wanted to.
I think it's just Jell-O.
Just fill a bathtub full of lube and Jell-O, and there you go. Have fun. It's like you're in the Great Link.
You know, I was wondering what I was going to do tomorrow on my day off, and I think my day has been filled. Stay tuned to this channel for the live stream of me attempting to swim in a Founder Lake.
One thing the documentary did spend a strange amount of time on was everyone's favorite hologram, Vic Fontaine.
Oh, and that was one thing that I hated when the show was on. I never really liked when Vic Fontaine was around. Maybe I'm in
there
the
was
minority.
One episode I liked with Vic. Actually, maybe two. So the my favorite Vic episode is the episode where Nog lives in the holodeck.
Yeah, the ROM rehab.
His PTSD episode. I thought that was an amazing episode.
I don't think I ever saw that episode.
Really. It's worth it. It's really worth it.
Yeah, it's because Nog's performance, he absolutely crushes it out of the park. And for a Hollywood actor to understand what it's, you know, to portray a veteran coming home scarred and doing a wonderful job.
Yeah.
As a vet who has come home scarred,
yeah.
I can speak a little bit to that he nails it.
And then the other one is when Vic is helping Odo, figure out how to approach Kira with his feelings. But they put way too much emphasis on Vic, and everybody loves Vic, and I'm like, I don't get it.
I never got it.
I mean, he's kind of the Guinan of this series. He's the one that the characters go to with their problems.
But he comes out of nowhere.
He does. I'm not a Vic Fontaine fan, and I don't really like that set. And that I'm not a fan of all of that. But I do like the Nog, that storyline of him being having that war injury. And to hear Aaron Eisenberg talk about it on the documentary was extremely emotional.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
I think I have to add in little tidbits. To bloom out the microphone of somebody who's eating on a live mic, so I'm just going to keep talking.
That's Will.
Yeah.
That's not me.
Yeah, there's that scene. Really?
Sorry, my mic's supposed to be muted. I'm sorry.
There's a scene. There's one of the episodes where they all go into the holodeck to play baseball.
Yes.
And Nog has to play baseball badly because Ferengi don't know how to play baseball, except that Aaron Eisenberg played like semi-pro ball. He's actually really good. And he couldn't flub his throws and his catches well enough to make it look convincing. So for all of the scenes where he's playing baseball, he put the glove on the wrong hand and he's throwing wrong-handed to make himself look bad on purpose.
They could have made him really good at baseball since he's been at Starfleet Academy and he has this...
No, it was ROM, not Nog.
I thought he said Aaron Eisenberg.
It's Nog that was the semi-pro ball player.
I thought it was ROM because that was the whole storyline.
Mm-mm.
I don't know then. Okay.
Oh, well, Nog definitely they say it on the documentary, but he is a character that had so much growth.
Yeah.
As a character. So
more so than Jake. You know, like,
yes.
You know, Jake had growth, but not as much.
Right. I guess. Yes. He didn't have as much growth, but I do like the growth that they did give Jake. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about our favorite episodes? Mine's The Visitor. There, I just said it.
Yes. We're talking about our favorite episodes now. So why is The Visitor your favorite?
The Visitor is an episode where Jake loses his father, thinks his father has been killed, and you see him as an adult and the way that tragedy has shaped his life. So Jake publishes a novel, but then he only publishes like one or two novels. He never really has a relationship. Like, he gets married, but then they get divorced, and he's just like, his life has just been stalled because of this tragedy and this, not just that his father died, but that his father periodically sort of comes back. And it's just like about a life interrupted. And it's just that, I feel like that's the tragedy, but it's also just about a son losing his father. And that's very sad.
And in this series, not only is this just like a big deal because it's his father, but we see how important Jake is to Sisko. That being a father is it's like father, emissary, captain, you know, and in addition to him always being there for Jake and that relationship being strong, they're physically affectionate. They're constantly telling each other that they love each other. That's not something you see on screen nearly enough.
Someone on Facebook posted that he's the best TV dad.
I agree.
I can see that. I think you can make that argument.
Absolutely. I agree.
favorite episode? Can we talk about Trials and Tribulations?
Before we get into that, I just want to say that Shane said in the chat that apparently the Borg cast hated the baseball episode. I did a quick Google. It is Rom that was the actual baseball player.
Yep, my bad. It is Max Grodinchik who was the semi-pro ball player.
So he can play ball, play a Ferengi, and sing really well. I hate you. That he had to play badly because he was written that way, because it was like the crux of the episode. So tell us, Trials and Tribulations.
Yeah, so let's make a throwaway episode to tip our cap over to TOS. Let's bring back Tribbles. Let's do a funky time travel episode. Let's find an excuse to put Terry Farrell into an original series miniskirt.
Yes, please.
Yes, please. You know, let's do all of these wonderfully cornball things. Let's find the old sets again.
Let's have Miles not able to actually fix or get into anything.
And they just had fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, splicing in the original footage and, you know, all those things. And it has one of the greatest things in all of Trek where they just... You know, writers be writers. It's like, hey, how are we going to get around the fact that the Klingons in the original series don't look like the Klingons do now that we have, you know, all these facial prosthetics? Why do the Klingons look different? Worf, we don't discuss it with outsiders. Drops mic, stops talking, end of discussion, never mentioned again.
And no matter what they said in Enterprise, that's the real answer.
We don't talk about it.
We don't talk about it with outsiders.
Yeah, I very much remember that episode. I went to the Smithsonian as a kid, and they had a Star Trek exhibit, and I got a stuffed Tribble. You could put batteries in it, it would purr, and if you would squeeze it, it would make a noise. And we got a VHS copy of Trouble with Tribbles, and I think that's probably the only original original Star Trek episode I've ever like seen like straight through.
Really?
So, I think so, probably, yeah.
There's... Wow. You know, and that's one of the big problems I'm having with Discovery is that the captain has a Tribble on his desk that like coos and chirps in most of the episodes, but at the other end of the desk he's got this bowl of food.
Fortune cookies.
The bowl of fortune cookies that's always there. I mean, why isn't that bowl of fortune cookies empty? And like every episode just have like one more Tribble and one more Tribble. And by the end of like the first season, they have to like snow shovel them out of the way to get to the window.
I think, and I have not watched all of Discovery, but they must have a containment field around that Tribble or something.
Or they spay and neuter their Tribbles.
Or they spay and neuter their
Tribbles. Or they throw them into the spore drive.
Oh, that's where the spores come from. There you go. That they should have used that instead of the tardigrade.
They should have had a Tribble episode of Disco. I don't know why they didn't do
that. Well, my theory is that Harry Mudd's going to come back and he's going to steal that Tribble. Because he's the one that sells the Tribbles in Trials and Tribulations.
Yeah. Trouble with Tribbles.
Or Trouble with Tribbles. Same episode. He sells it in both of them. Yeah. I love that. And the rotoscoping at that point was like revolutionary. I mean, we're talking, nobody else was doing it like that at that time. That was seamless. I really enjoyed that. Will, what's one of your favorite episodes?
Well, you brought up Trials and Tribulations because that reminded me that one of the local theaters for Black History Month, they had a double feature, Deep Space Nine. They had Trials and Tribulations and Far Beneath the Stars, which is one of my favorite episodes. I remember the hype leading up to the episode about how we're going to get to see the actors outside of their makeup for the first time. And I thought that was really cool. I had no idea what a lot of them looked like in real
Probably
life.
One of the best episodes of sci-fi ever written.
It was amazing, actually. How much it's based on what was actually happening in sci-fi
in
history.
Time,
yeah, that to me was such a... That one and the time travel one where he plays Gabriel...
Past tense.
Yes, that one. I can't remember the guy's name. Gabriel something.
Gabriel Bell.
Gabriel, I'm like, it's not Byrne because that's an actor. Yeah. Gabriel Bell,
where they go to that ghetto and they're there leading the resistance and the start of the war.
And as someone who lives in the Bay Area, let me tell you that they're not too far off.
No, and those to me are like some of the most powerful episodes in Deep Space Nine. And it just
because it's real. It's not like a you know, a made up war against, you know, some made up alien from some other star. It's you know, it's real stuff. It really happened like that. And, you know, wars really, you know, rebellions really do happen like that. And people really are oppressed. And to watch, you know, amazing actors, you know, absolutely chew the curtains off of well-written scenes, you get gold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Avery Brooks directed, didn't they say?
Yes.
For Mr. Taurus, yeah.
Avery Brooks directed quite a number of episodes.
But I think, was that his first that he directed? Or was it just really important that he
be
the one?
I don't think so. Oh.
Because they did talk about how it was really important that if anybody were going to need to direct this, it would be him. And one of the things that I did notice in this documentary is whenever they showed you the writers, the crew, everyone that worked behind the scenes, the producers, the directors, they were all white. And I think they were 100% correct. When you're doing an episode like that, you can't have a white director.
He directed 9 episodes. That was the 8th episode that he directed.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He had
his feet underneath him by that point, you know.
Yeah,
he knew what he was doing. There is that. There was that one montage they put in the documentary where they showed exactly how many scenes they had of an all-black cast on camera,
mm-hmm.
and not just for snippets. You know, for whole scenes or acts.
And they do point out in the documentary, like, this isn't a time when you didn't have that on TV unless it was quote unquote a black show. You know, it was on BET or something like that.
Or it had Cosby in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is problematic now for other reasons.
Myriad of reasons, yes.
I just want to say that Penny Johnson-Gerald, who played Cassidy Yates, is now a regular on The Orville. Please
and
watch The Orville.
She's awesome.
Because she's amazing on The Orville. So.
She has not aged a day. Like, seriously?
Yeah, really good.
She is a very pretty, talented lady.
Mm-hmm. Pretty and talented. Very much so. But no, I mean, like, I think that what we got is even the green actors, because there were some seriously established actors, they all got to learn from those established actors and they got to grow in a good environment. The fact that the main character was black and it was, I have a son and that's going to be my main focus, that then influenced everything else that came. And thankfully, you know, as they said, we could do a montage where how many scenes did we have where there were only people of color on the screen?
Speaking of montages, is anything as 90s as a montage with Meredith Brooks's bitch playing in the background?
That was
a montage that happened.
I was like, that might be a little too.
That's a little too much.
Yeah,
that's very 90s.
Yeah. So, I can't think. There's so many episodes that I could say are my favorite, but there are some standouts for sure. Like it's really hard for me to choose just one. And I think all of what you have said are really amazing episodes. I had one in my head and now it's gone, but that's okay. Cause I am going to go to, the episode where he's telling the story of how he gets the Romulans into the war.
Oh yeah.
And then
I love
deletes
that episode.
It at
that's
the end.
So good.
It's such a good episode because it's, I know I'm breaking every rule. And
I
this
think
is something that I
in
have
the
to
pale
live
moonlight.
With. Yeah. Yes, it is the pale moonlight. And it's something that he has to live with. And he has to know that he did the wrong thing. But he does it anyway. And it just, that to me shows everything that I love about Deep Space Nine is it's gray.
Yes.
Everyone is gray. There are no black and white heroes. You know, no one is 100% good. No one is 100% bad. Everyone is gray. And everyone's doing their very best. And that, to me, was Deep Space Nine. And I would crowdfund, I would watch, I would spend $20 on Crave a month if I could have a Season 8. Is there anything anybody wants to mention before we wrap this up?
Nope, I hit all my bullet points.
It was really good. The Blu-ray comes out August 6th. So you've got some time. You can pre-order it.
Yep, and my my note on that is the same note I always make to nerds out there and to our fellow geeks, that money talks, guys. If you like Star Trek, if you liked Deep Space Nine, if you like sci-fi, speak with your wallet, buy the documentary, and show them that, you know, make this thing a hit so that they'll make more like it, or they'll make more episodes of the shows that we do like. If all we do is, you know, sit in a rock in a cave with our fingers in our ears and our eyes closed, pretending the world doesn't exist, nothing gets made, nothing happens. But, you know, how was this documentary made? By
people putting their money, by
funders putting some money in, just a couple dollars each, until they got funded, and you know they ended up crushing their sponsorship goals, and they made an amazing documentary.
Nothing told me that I wanted to see a Deep Space Nine movie, which we were promised when it ended, more than seeing the remastered footage on the big screen.
Oh, the battle scene.
Yeah,
I think that you know, if we support Star Trek in this way, we show them that we care. And I still don't get how they started this documentary like Deep Space Nine was seen as the worst Star Trek when it really is the best. Like, come on, Voyager's the worst.
I would say Enterprise. Yeah. But I think it's very odd that we haven't had a series that took place after Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Until this Picard series, I guess, would be the first one.
Yeah, everything else was a prequel.
Yeah.
Well, and that which goes to Rick Berman saying that there are no new stories, and he's wrong.
I'm tired of.
Dumb.
Yes. So tired of prequels and alternate universes.
Just carry on the story after the Dominion War and keep telling us new stories with new ships. It certainly makes a lot more sense to keep having the technology march forward and have the ships look newer and newer than trying to like retcon ideas on why an old ship looks new.
Yeah.
It's also really cool that Deep Space Nine introduced Section 31, and that's going to be a spinoff show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That show, Section 31, shows up in Disco in Season 2. So that's something that Deep Space Nine gave to the Star Trek universe.
Those are great episodes, too. Those mm-hmm. are really great episodes. Yep. And Deep Space Nine, there's no new stories? We introduced a wormhole and an entire other quadrant that you can explore.
If you think that your Star Trek show has run out of stories, I don't know what to tell you, man.
You need to quit Star Trek. Go talk to the fans, read the fan fiction, read the role plays. Trust me, there's a lot more stories.
Go ahead.
You can do anything you want in a Star Trek show. You could even take the lead characters of your starship and turn them into salamanders.
No, you can't do that. You can't do that.
No.
That never happened.
Well, you can do that and then have that show stricken from canon.
Yeah, 2 weeks after airing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And that's why Voyager's the worst.
Well, yes. A lot of valleys. valleys, yes.
Even the animated series never had anything stricken from canon. That's saying something.
Alamo Range.
All right. So, Matt, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
You can find me at hooplecast.com. That's the website for the podcast that I do. It's about Deadwood. Well, it started to be about Deadwood. And now, since Deadwood is over, we are talking about the first episode of every HBO dramatic series that ever aired. We most recently covered what? I don't know. Something.
Game of Thrones.
Empire, Mildred Pierce, and something else. I don't know. Game of Thrones. Yes.
Game of Thrones, yeah.
I've heard of it. Game of Thrones, you say.
and you're going to be doing the movie. That's
the Deadwood movie comes out in 2 weeks. Oh, my God. This thing that was never supposed to happen is actually made and is coming out. We can see it with our eyes in 2 weeks. It's incredible. We're going to do a commentary. We're going to do two episodes talking about it. It's pretty big. So find us at hooplecast.com. Or go on Facebook and search for Hooplecast and join our Facebook group.
And the funniest bit is if you listen to the early episodes, there are times when the cast is talking about, oh, this Deadwood movie. Yeah, that's never happening. That's never happening. And it's all a joke. And then now it's happening.
Oh, and by the way, the movie that I mentioned earlier is a Dakota Fanning, not Elle Fanning. So I can see why you were confused, Nutty.
I still didn't know of it.
You got the Fanning sisters mixed up. It's called Please Stand By. And I'll just quickly read the tagline or the plot description. Wendy, a brilliant and autistic young woman with a fixation on Star Trek, lives a routine life in an Oakland, California group home where she's monitored by her primary caregiver. She spends her time writing a 450-page Star Trek script to enter in Paramount Pictures screenwriting contest in hopes of winning the $100,000 prize. And one of the actors in the movie is Robin Weigert, who plays Calamity Jane on Deadwood. So
I have to see this movie.
I think it's available on Hulu. Anyway.
All right. Will, where can people find you?
You can find me with Matt on Spartacast, which is about the Star series Spartacus, which I think we'll be finishing up soon. We're on the last season. And you can also find me on the Defenders podcast with Claire and Tammy, which we'll be starting that back up when Jessica Jones season 3 is released.
What? And they can also find your finished podcast.
Yes, Down Below, which is a Babylon 5 podcast, and also the Sensate podcast,
which is kind of a binge cast. The Down Below podcast is the only intro cast where the newbies were in Hook, Line, and Sinker from the first season.
Yeah.
Every other intro cast, it takes them a while to love the series.
Yeah, they were into it. Yeah. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And write in, listen for the links at the end of the outro, and tell us what did Deep Space Nine mean to you? Tell us your favorite episode. Come to the Facebook group or email in and let us know what's your favorite episode and what did it mean to you? We want to thank our patrons that without them, we would only be doing one episode a month instead of two episodes a month. So thank you so much to Aaron Jackson.
Thanks, Big Daddy.
Thank you to... Oh, wait. I got to sort this. Here we go. Thank you to our other Big Daddy, Jason Banks of the Talk Nerdy to Me podcast. Thank you to Andy Luke. Check out his books on Amazon. Thank you to Susanna. Thank you to Shane of the Red Dwarf Intro Cast.
Thanks,
thank
Shane.
You to Will. Oh, wait. Hi, Will.
Hi,
thank
Will.
of the Spartacast down below and Sensate. There it is. Thank you, Zach Mann. Thank you, Greg Larson. You can also get his books on Amazon. And thank you to the Radical Geek. Radical Geek. There we go. Thank you, Steve Pritchard. Thank you to Susan. Thank you to Lynette McFadden of Binet USA. Thank you to Melissa A. Bartell, the Bathtub Mermaid. Thank you to Harold. Thank you to Ian, also of the Down Below podcast and the Web of Queer. Thank you to Rich the TT. Thank you to Patrick Scafito. Check him out on Amazon and get his books. Thank you to Ken Kennedy of Kenzoid's Autonomous Zone. Thank you to Kinsey of Brazilianisms, but I don't think that's an active podcast, but you can listen to old episodes. Thank you to Mike of the Redacted Files. Thank you to Justine. You can find her on Patreon. Thank you to Dagny, and I think that's everyone.
And sometimes Nick.
Nick hasn't done it in a while, so we stopped thanking
him. That's why he's back to sometimes.
Ah, sometimes Nick.
Instead of usually Nick.
Yes. Thank you so much. Without you, we'd only be doing this once a month, if that, and you help pay for the server costs and getting our butts in the chair. Thank you so much. And we'll talk to y'all later. Thank you for joining us, Matt and Will. And thank you for joining us in the chat, Shane and Michael. Bye. This is where you say bye.
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 Shane, I've done it.
Again, Paul, then open the window. There's no need to announce it.
No, not that. I've invented a machine that can erase our memory of Red Dwarf so you can watch it for the first time. Again.
Really? Is it safe?
Completely. Although you might also forget how to read, write, and do math.
I'm a politician. I don't need any of that.
Also, it would probably make your head explode.
And ruin my hair? No. Let's just find a lovely American couple who have barely even heard of Red Dwarf to watch the show with us. That'll be the next best thing to seeing it for the first time.
Hi, I'm Angela. This is my husband, Heath.
What are you doing in my house?
Well, we're just your everyday American couple wandering about looking for someone who feels like watching a show we've barely even heard of with us.
Maybe recording a podcast about it.
Hmm, That's really convenient.
And you can listen in on the fun with the Red Dwarf Intro Cast.
Check us out on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter.
Red Lights is produced by Nimlas Studios under a Creative Commons Attribution No Commercial Non-Derivatives 3.0 International License. That means you can't change it without my permission. You can share it and send it to your friends. Just link back to me, my site, and everything. We live at nimlas.org, which has links to everything social media, including facebook.com/group/nuttybites and patreon.com/nukejoss, or call 347-NUTTY42.